Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. Sometimes a problem is so big, so daunting, that we feel powerless to confront it. Take climate change. Globally, our industrial way of life pumps roughly 40 billion tons of carbon emissions into the atmosphere every year. This thickening gas cloud prevents dissipation of the Earth's heat and results in potentially devastating changes in weather and temperature. As governments around the world wrestle with ways to reduce carbon use, is there anything that we, regular folks in regular communities, can do? Mindy Aller and Ryan Hall say yes, and they're riding their bicycles from Oregon to Washington, D.C. to make their case. Mindy and Ryan, many thanks for joining us on Home Ground. Mindy, where'd you grow up? What'd your folks do?
I grew up in St. Paul, Minnesota. My father was a sociology professor at the University of St. Thomas, and my mother stayed home with my brother and I until we went to school, and then she did various administrative jobs with different organizations.
Okay. When did you leave home, and where did you go to college?
I went to the University of St. Thomas, which was literally a mile from home, but I moved on campus, but that was the best tuition deal since my dad was a professor there.
And if you look back at yourself as a teenager getting away to go to college, what were your central values and where did they come from?
Looking back now, I see different things than I probably saw at that time. I started out going to college for a technical side, was a computer science major with a math minor. But now looking back, I see how important the whole social justice philosophy was in my household. Mm-hmm. I grew up in a Catholic household with parents that were both educated by Jesuits and had both an uncle and a great uncle that were Jesuits. And that
now you have a Pope that's a Jesuit.
Now we have a Pope that's a Jesuit, yes. And that has carried through very much as a strong ethic in my upbringing.
When did that begin to influence your actions, your choice of work, your choice of civic engagement? When and how?
I started out working in the corporate world and then got involved with my church and went on a trip to Guatemala. And that helped me see how the rest of the world lived.
What did you see?
Understanding people that lived in poverty by nothing more than incident of birth, that they had very few economic resources, but at the same time, they have very strong community. So now this is more than 20 years ago that I'm still involved with my church and this community, Tierra Nueva Dos in Guatemala. We've had more than 20 years of a relationship between our two communities.
Poverty is a word that's a concept defined differently by different people. Give me an example of someone who lives in poverty or lived in poverty in Guatemala that you knew.
My friends Efrain and Estella and their three children, Norma, Juan Felipe, and Josefina, lived in a home that they had pulled together themselves with wood and plastic that eventually, as they raise more money, they have cement block that they slowly reconstruct the house out of cement block. But they had a dirt floor in their home. Efrain actually died of cancer, and their daughter Norma died also of cancer just after having her first baby when she was in her early 20s. So they are brilliant people and strong community members that give a lot in their community of serving others, always looking to how they can help others that are poorer than they are in their community.
Do they have medical care and food?
No. A cancer diagnosis in this community in Guatemala really means a death sentence because they don't have access to the kind of medical care that we have here.
Ryan Hall, how about you? Where'd you grow up? What'd your folks do?
I grew up in Livonia, Michigan, a suburb of Detroit. My mom is a photographer and part-time job enthusiast, alongside my father, who graduated from Michigan State University in journalism. He was a freelance writer and worked any job he could in a really tough Michigan economy.
And what period are we talking about?
We're talking about when 2008 and 2009 hit with the recession, when Michigan reached 20% unemployment.
Huh.
My father experienced that, and we felt the burst of the real estate bubble really severely.
So you were born when?
I was born in 1993.
So you're in your early teens when this happens?
That's correct. I was in high school when the recession took place.
I know it was extremely tough for the state of Michigan. 20% employment begins to approach that of the Great Depression. How is it now for the state and your family if you still live there?
It's still very difficult to maintain the standard of living that people once knew. Mm. My parents are baby boomers. They were much older when they had me, but they lived very comfortably as kids with their parents, but it's extremely difficult to make a living. So my father worked very many part-time jobs just to scrape by.
How about education after high school?
I attended a couple of years of college, but after tuition hikes, I couldn't take out any more money than I already was. So I came across an opportunity called AmeriCorps, and that's when I moved to Columbus, Ohio to serve with City Year, and thus began my 3 years of service with AmeriCorps in Ohio, in Colorado, and last year in Iowa.
We've interviewed quite a few AmeriCorps volunteers over time, but I can't remember the compensation structure. How does it work?
Well, I received a living stipend, which was still a poverty wage, and was able to receive state and federal assistance. But I also received an education award that would be used towards future tuition or to pay off the public debt that I had accumulated.
How was the experience? 3 years is more than most people serve.
The experience was humbling and opened up my eyes to the injustices and inequality that takes place anywhere from rural America to urban America and everywhere in between. As someone who grew up in a very cushy suburb, living, you know, a lower middle class white suburban life, I experienced poverty in poor education, where less than 60% of students graduated from the high school I worked at in Columbus.
What was your job there?
I was a tutor and mentor for 9th and 10th grade students who were many levels behind in math and English.
I know what a tutor is. What do you mean by mentor?
I would follow a cohort of students to each of their classes. So I followed them when their teachers didn't. So I followed up with students in most all of their subjects throughout high school. So I became a very close adult figure in their life for the year that I had served.
Close adult meaning a relationship.
Correct.
Was that important to them?
Absolutely. In a community where parents are overworked or not present, it's hard to come by an adult figure in their lives that is reliable or has their best intentions in their heart.
Can you give me an example of a mentoring of a kid that made a difference in your mind?
I worked with a student who had to move to the States from Mexico after his father had committed suicide. And through mentoring, I was able to encourage him to pursue education as a possibility, where he thought that only military or work was his future. He attended a field trip to a local university and afterwards told me that he would want to pursue an education, and this was an event that really spoke to me and the value of mentoring young people.
Mindy, I think it's fair to say you're on a long bicycle trip. What generated the idea?
The trip is called Low Carbon Crossings. It's an idea that came from a friend of mine of combining concern for climate change with bicycle touring, which is a low carbon way of traveling.
Low carbon indeed.
Although we eat more, which does increase our carbon footprint a little bit that way. But it doesn't use fuel, it doesn't use gasoline to power the bikes. It's human powered. And I think it also opens us up to more conversation with people, because on a bicycle, you've put yourself in a much more vulnerable position. And I think it makes us more approachable. People will come up and just ask us questions about what are you doing and where are you going. That doesn't happen if you're in a car. We were in Lolo, Montana, in the McDonald's, and as we were walking out, a couple stopped us to ask, you know, where are we going, what are we doing? And turns out they were visiting from Tennessee, but were just fascinated by having passed us earlier in the day in their car when we were biking alongside the road.
As you bike along the road, I see you're both wearing T-shirts, Low Carbon Crossings on the front of the T-shirts. Does it say the same on the back?
On the back it says, Cycling Towards Climate Solutions.
Huh, all right. Tell me about it, Cycling Towards Climate Solutions.
The idea is to engage people in conversations in ways that we can impact climate change for the better, looking at ways that we can reduce our own energy consumption, recycle more, buying local foods, supporting our local economies, and then also looking towards policy work, which I do through the Citizens Climate Lobby.
policy work potentially involving government policy?
Specifically involving federal government policy. I'm a regional coordinator for Citizens Climate Lobby, and we are proposing a policy called carbon fee and dividend, which would be a revenue-neutral way of pricing carbon. You put a price on carbon at its source, and you give that money all back to households. So instead of the government deciding how to keep the money, we as individuals get the money back, and we decide how we're going to spend it.
We interviewed Congressman Inglis. He was supporting that same proposal, if I'm not mistaken.
Absolutely. Bob Inglis is on our advisory board for Citizens Climate Lobby.
Former Republican told me that by coming out with that proposal, supporting it, it cost him his primary election, which otherwise was well assured. It was an interesting discussion. That suggested to me his experience that at least in his congressional district, people weren't receptive to that concept. What's your thought about it? Why should people support this idea?
Climate change is impacting everyone, and I think we're finding, especially in the younger generations, there's no doubt that this is an impact on their future and that we need to be doing more about it. So even when visiting congressional offices in June with Citizens Climate Lobby in Washington, D.C., we had a lot of young staff members. They're all in their early 20s,
right.
Many of them in Republican offices. And I think they're looking for what are solutions that they can bring to their boss. What are ways that we can help our conservative members of Congress who recognize that climate change is happening? They do know that there's something happening and that we need to do it. But as a party, that they have been very offended by the solutions that have been put forward.
I would have to say not just offended by solutions. There are many Republicans who, as a matter of the party itself, seems to pretty well deny that climate change is a reality. Prominent members of the Senate, Imhoff, I think, out of Oklahoma, for example, calls it a hoax, as do quite a few candidates for public office. So you're saying that in your direct experience, staff members to Republican House and or Senate members are receptive and looking for a way to deal with the issue that is, say, in tune with their, I'll call it a pro-market philosophy.
Exactly. They clearly, our experience in many Republican offices as well as Democratic offices as a general experience of all of our volunteers from Citizens Climate Lobby in June was a lot more in-depth questions of asking what our policy was all about and really trying to understand the solution that we were putting forth and how it might fit with their philosophy of being a market-driven solution as opposed to something that would grow government.
You're listening to Homeground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with Mindy Aller and Ryan Hall, who are traveling across the United States on bicycles to stimulate discussion of climate change solutions.
An example of the way that Democrats and Republicans are now coming together, there's a Climate Solutions Caucus that was started in the U.S. House of Representatives. It was started by Carlos Cubello, who represents Southern Florida, including Miami, along with he's a Republican, and his Democratic colleague, Ted Deutsch, also representing South Florida. They have come together and have created this Climate Solutions Caucus for Democrats and Republicans to talk about what can be done, because Florida is an example of a community on the front line.
On the front line, why?
As they said, sea levels are rising, and in Florida, they can't build a wall to keep it out, because the rock in Florida is porous. So as the sea level rises, it would come up from the ground. They can't build a wall. So they recognize the danger to their own communities and that something needs to be done about it. So there are now 20 members of this Climate Solutions Caucus, 10 Republicans and 10 Democrats, and they must join with someone from the opposite party. So they have to join two by two to become a member of this caucus.
Interesting concept. I hadn't heard about it. Your comment about Florida reminds me that somewhere recently I read that almost half of the world's people live within 60 miles of the coastline. Major cities are right on the water's edge, and a rise of 2 or 3 feet, which is projected depending on which study you look at over the next 75 years, will have disastrous consequences for hundreds of millions of people. They're going to have to move somewhere. Has that come across either of your desks in terms of concerns in the conversations that you've been having with people?
Absolutely. We've come across people in Portland and Clarkston that are concerned about climate refugees or people moving inward from the coastline as it rises. So with more difficulty in acquiring jobs or our livelihoods being at stake, people are concerned about more people moving inland, just as Europe is really concerned about refugees of any variety. And you can see the results of xenophobia or just a fear of what is to come of millions of people entering a place that they've never been before.
I was talking to some people in southwest United States about the temperatures rising over time, changes in water, rainfall levels, and the concerns for small Mexican farmers who are living kind of on the edge already. If the temperatures change, the folks I talk to fear that the immigration issue that we now deal with will be look like child's play compared to people needing to relocate to try to earn a living.
An example of that is the climate is changing in areas where we grow coffee, cocoa, and grapes, which we use for wine. So three things that impact a lot of small farmers, for one, and their livelihoods, but also three things that a lot of us really enjoy consuming.
I was going to say, if you threaten wine, I mean, you might have an uprising in this country.
To me, chocolate's even more important.
I see. Well, we can talk about that after the show. In the material you gave me prior to the show, I was surprised to see some of the folks and organizations that have endorsed this concept of a fee that is then passed on to the people of the United States. Charles Krauthammer is a noted conservative syndicated columnist. David Brooks endorses the concept of a tax not necessarily passed on to the consumers. George Shultz, former Secretary of State under President Bush, has endorsed the full proposal that you're advocating, and so has, if I remember correctly, ExxonMobil Corporation. Someone might say, what's going on here where pretty conservative folks are endorsing the idea of a fee imposed on carbon emissions? Do I have that right?
That's correct.
Okay, and then distributing that money to the American people according to the size of your family, if I get it.
Correct.
What do they see in this?
For one, from a conservative perspective, it's looking at those externalized costs, and this carbon pollution that's causing the problem has not had any cost associated with it. So it's simply putting a correct fee on that. So the proposal is that it would start at $15 a ton and rise by $10 a ton every year. The fee is placed at the source, where it first enters our economy, at the well, at the port of entry, at the mine. That's where the fee is put onto our carbon emissions.
Okay, the fee is then collected. And what are the projections, let's just take, if it starts in year X and it's $15 a ton of projected emission, what are the numbers? Again, just some of the research I did, it's stunning numbers. According to The Economist, the United States produces 5.6 billion tons of carbon emissions each year. We have 330 million people. So how does that boil down in terms of distribution to the average family in this hypothetical scenario?
So based on a study done by Regional Economic Modeling Incorporated, an independent modeling organization, in the first year of family of four, two adults and two dependent children, would receive just under $50 a month in dividend. And that rises to $288 a month for that same family of four 10 years after the fee is implemented.
Okay, Ryan, so let's explore how it works. You're going to get money every month, but the things you buy, starting with energy, have carbon in them. So do plastic water bottles. There'll be some impact on prices. How does it net out in terms of the projections?
Right. So since carbon is incorporated in most parts of the economy, the dividend would help more than half, 53% of households have a net gain. So the dividend would be more than how more expensive items and purchases will become. And another 20% would basically break even.
Okay, so that's more than 70% of the American people under this scenario, assuming the statistics have been correctly evaluated, benefit financially. is there an income correlation? I'm thinking that wealthy people tend to spend more on consumer products. You're saying there's carbon in most consumer products, so they end up probably on the downhill side of this.
That's correct. So if you're on the lower end, if you're making less income, you're not as contributing as much to pollution, and so it's more likely that you have a net gain from the dividend.
Okay, so just given that fact, on the wealthier side, broadly speaking, conservative political people tend to be concerned about protecting wealth and reducing taxes. If we follow experience, emphasizing reduction on taxes for the wealthy as the quote-unquote job producers, how do you explain the support you're getting from conservative Republicans?
Conservatives like it because it's a market-driven solution. So the government hasn't picked the winners and losers. They've put the money back into the economy, giving it back to households. It spurs innovation by businesses because they can see that there's a steady rising cost. It starts at $15 a ton. It goes up $10 a ton every year. Businesses can plan for that in their long-range plan, and it encourages them to find more efficient ways of doing business.
Less carbon dependent, therefore reducing the price of their product in comparison with the products they currently market, because carbon is less expensive.
Exactly.
It's disincentive to use carbon dependent products.
Exactly. And most people are driven by price when making purchasing decisions.
Okay, that's looking at the impact on families and spending. What's the impact on carbon emissions projected to be?
So according to the REMI study, in 10 years, carbon emissions would fall 31% below 1990 levels. And in 2050, it would fall 80% below 1990 levels, which is on track for the Climate Summit agreement that we must keep our temperature rise below 2 degrees Celsius, because after we raise our temperature 2 degrees Celsius, that's when temperatures start going out of control, where disaster and climate zones are shifting, where we are really impacted by
sea level rise, that sort of thing.
That's correct.
So tell us about the nuts and bolts of riding from Oregon so far to Montana and then Washington, D.C. You rode up here on bicycles to the top of this hill. I didn't see a car. Is there a car that you use, or you're strictly those two bikes?
That's right. There's no car involved. We're just carrying everything on our bicycles.
Everything meaning what?
Everything from camping materials, clothes, food, the whole, everything we need to really travel across the country.
So you're trying to make a point?
We're making a point that we can travel across the country in a low-carbon way while talking about climate solutions in every community that we do pass through.
How do you set up meetings to talk to people unless you stop and just say, hey, excuse me, and then you talk to somebody on the sidewalk?
We have an amazing group of volunteers who are helping coordinate these presentations in each community. So that means we are speaking at churches, at breweries, and we are presenting not only the policies that we're talking about, we're also encouraging local action and solutions, meaning market solutions, buying local food, or getting on your bicycle, or doing these very low carbon ways that any community can do across the U.S.
In those discussions, have you encountered criticism of the proposal?
We have. We met a gentleman in Clarkston that did a lot of work in Niger and has seen the result of climate zones shifting. So people living in Niger not being able to grow and harvest what they're used to. So he sees the dividend as a way for people in the U.S. to spend more money to emit more carbon. So he would like to see the fee do some sort of justice for those countries and those people most affected by climate change.
The list is impressive that you give for those who've endorsed various actions on climate change, the specific proposal that you're talking about. I don't see any environmental organizations or conservation groups. What's your thought about that?
The process of actually getting endorsements has been a fairly new one. So just within the last year have our Citizens Climate Lobby volunteers really been seeking specific endorsements from organizations. So it's become a more concerted effort right now.
And I would assume you'd start with conservative interests, because that is considered the tougher sell for serious climate action.
That's the key. If we don't get conservatives working with us to find a solution, we will never get anything passed through our federal government.
So how many, you mentioned you're meeting with community people in different towns. How many in Montana, for example?
In Montana, we have 7 and possibly 8 different locations where we're having community conversations.
I would assume the tendency is to attract people who already are committed on climate change. Fair?
That's true.
Okay. How do you get beyond them?
So one way is by bringing cycling into it, reaching out to the bicycling community, which are not necessarily environmentalists.
Sure.
But then also looking for other opportunities, hunting and fishing, especially in Montana. The fly fishing shops have provided some places for conversation, one-on-one, with a fly shop owner in Ovando who said, you know, I don't know why the stream levels are low, but he had a chart right there on the wall of how stream levels were dropping. And he said, in looking at these numbers, he said, if we continue to have years like this, you know, when the water levels are low, the temperatures warm up, and we have to limit the amount of fishing, and that impacts his business.
Yeah, it's interesting to see various economic interests and how they might break out on it. And as you go east, you're going to run into coal miners. Mindy, it's not a hypothetical question. In Montana, there are a lot of people who depend directly on the coal industry. What do you have to say to them?
I think that, for one, our people that work in the fossil fuel industry and in the coal industry have as much concern for their children and their grandchildren as the rest of us. We all want a better place for future generations to live in. We need to be concerned about the jobs that they currently depend on and help them in finding high-quality jobs to replace them, something that's cleaner energy, that's better for our planet. It is a real issue.
We met a gentleman along the way who works with a gas company in North Dakota, and part of his job is reducing the waste of how much methane is flared off, because once the gas was found in the Bakken, a lot of it was being flared off, and so he is trying to capture some of that energy that is being lost. And his hiring manager said, you know, eventually we're going to work ourselves away from this job and into a new one in a clean energy. And so this gentleman we met is very proud of the work that he's doing and really hopes that one day he'll be working towards a cleaner energy economy.
What happens when you get to Washington, D.C.?
The trip is intentionally planned so that we arrive in D.C. just as the Citizens Climate Lobby is having Congressional Education Days. So we'll be joined by volunteers that have come from all over the country. We'll arrive by bicycle and can join in with others who are constituents of some of the states we've gone through and join in their lobbying efforts to bring some of the stories of people that we've met along the way.
And what's the date?
We will arrive November 13th, and the 14th and 15th we have training and then lobbying.
Mindy and Ryan, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for joining us on Home Ground. And to our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studios. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.